Thanks for downloading Think from KERA 90.1 Dallas-Fort Worth. You can learn more and support this program at kera.org.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from the History Channel, presenting 1968 with Tom Brokaw, Sunday, December 9th at 9 p.m., 8 Central, on the History Channel.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Informal Courses for Adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What's the difference between race and ethnicity in American society, and who gets to decide which category individuals occupy? While federal census documents consider those who identify themselves as Hispanic to be members of an ethnic group rather than a separate race, my guest today argues that reality is far more complex for Mexican Americans. Laura E. Gomez is professor of law and American studies at the University of New Mexico. Her latest research explores the reasons why Mexican Americans have been considered white officially, but have never fully enjoyed the sorts of advantages that come with being perceived as white socially. The book is called Manifest Destinies, The Making of the Mexican-American Race. Laura, welcome to Think.
Thank you. I'm happy to be with you today.
How would you characterize the difference between race and ethnicity?
Well, it's a little bit complex in terms of how social scientists might approach these terms, but I think the easiest way to think about it is to think of race as being something that we are assigned in society. So, for instance, as we walk down the street, we pretty quickly and subconsciously assign people to a particular racial group, whereas ethnicity is something much more likely to be chosen by a person. So if race is a harder category, ethnicity is a softer category. For instance, if somebody is third or fourth generation Italian-American, they can choose how much that's going to be part of their life. Is it going to be something that comes up in holidays at particular times or family celebrations, or that kind of thing? And that's very different than the fact that somebody assigns you to a particular racial category. So that's sort of the major distinction.
So your research looked primarily at Mexican Americans living in New Mexico, where you live now. Can you explain what made that the ideal place to study this issue?
Absolutely. When I started doing this research, I was interested in that transition between the Mexican legal system and the American legal system that occurred when the U.S. took control of what was then northern Mexico, about half of northern Mexico, and an area of 1.3 million square miles, which is an area that led to a threefold increase in the size of the United States at the time. And I started to research this area and realized, to my surprise, even as somebody who had been fairly knowledgeable about history, that almost that two-thirds of the people who lived in that vast area of the Mexican Cession lived in what is present-day New Mexico. That land also included Texas and California. Texas by reason that the U.S. By reason that Mexico had not given up its control of Texas or had not formally relinquished it to the United States until 1848, when the war ended. So there were way fewer Mexicans in California and Texas than in New Mexico. And so that's reason number one. The other reasons have to do with the paucity of white Euro-Americans who were in New Mexico compared to Texas and California. Texas had more white Europeans than Mexicans by the 1830s, when it was still part of Mexico. California had more Euro-Americans than Mexican-Americans by 1850, after it was part of the United States. In New Mexico, we still have a majority, so-called majority-minority state, which means that there are more Mexican-Americans and Indians and people of African-American and Asian-American descent living in New Mexico than whites living in New Mexico today.
How did the American colonization change the way that Mexican Americans defined themselves as separate from their Native American neighbors?
Well, one of the, you know, it's hard to answer that in a nutshell version, but one of the primary distinctions was that Mexican Americans were given citizenship at the end of the war, and Pueblo Indians and other Indians were excluded from citizenship at that time. And one of the facets of that was that Mexican Americans were allowed to claim that they were white to a certain extent. For example, if we look back to 1848 and U.S. immigration policy at that time, only whites could become naturalized U.S. citizens. That means that people of color from Africa, perhaps from the Middle East, from Asia, could not become naturalized citizens. And yet in 1848, Congress, in approving the treaty, rather the Senate in approving the treaty and the president in signing it, gave this collective naturalization to 115,000 Mexicans at the time, whom people considered non-white. You know, if you look at the congressional debate and the press at that time period, it was pretty clear that Mexicans were not considered white.
So part of the issue, I guess, there was they were perhaps socially considered not white, and they probably looked very similar to their neighbors who were Pueblo Indians, but they might have had some Spanish, which is European, blood.
That's right. And so I argue that there was a dynamic going on which sort of allowed Mexican-Americans, by virtue of saying, well, we have this small Spanish ancestry which allows us to claim that were white. I argue that it's a reverse one-drop rule when we compare it to African-Americans who have, at least since the first couple of decades of the 20th century in the United States, were defined as black if they had one drop of African ancestry.
So how did wealthy and prominent Mexicans who were living in what is now New Mexico, how did they fare during the time of all this as the U.S. took over this territory?
Well, they were in a pretty interesting position. They were able to parlay their influence under the Mexican government, and sometimes government positions like justice of the peace or a law enforcement kind of position, into positions under the new American government. And in some ways, there were also new opportunities for democratic participation that was opened up. For example, sitting on a jury, which many of us might think today is not the most fun thing to do, was incorporated into New Mexico after 1848, and Mexican Americans, because they were the vast majority of the population, were the vast majority of the jurors. So I guess on the one hand, I'd say what I call elite Mexican Americans became continued to hold some political power after the Americans took over this region. But there was another way in which, at the same time, that supported the American control of the region, and so ultimately, over time, led to less power for those elite Mexican Americans.
So in 1848, there certainly were not a lot of European Americans living in what is now New Mexico, and there were very, very few African Americans living there. How did Mexican Americans start to formulate their view of black and African Americans as compared with themselves? And at what point did that start to be something that was even part of their worldview?
Right. That is a terrific question. But before I get right to it, I just want to give a little bit of additional context for our listeners, which is in the book, I argue that Mexican Americans are not only part Indian and part Spanish, but also part African in our heritage. In fact, if you go back to the Mexico-New Spain region of about, I think we're talking about 1650 here, there were equal numbers of Africans who had been brought to Mexico as slaves as there were Spaniards at that time, and 10 times as many Indians in the population at that time. So if you sort of think about over time how that mix occurs, you would get a population which is primarily indigenous, but which had these elements of European and African ancestry. So that's a little footnote that I would just add, if you don't mind, before your question. Now,
sure.
Let me get to the question of sort of not the Indo-Afro-Mestizos, who were the Mexican-Americans themselves, but how they were thinking about African-Americans and at this time, right? So on the cusp of the Civil War, let's say. Mexican-Americans here were interacting with Euro-Americans in higher numbers and more frequency, and they were certainly following what was happening in Congress and in terms of North-South debate over slavery during this period. And so they were hearing references to, for example, the comment that Mexican Americans were no better than the Negroes was a debate that you would hear in Congress during the war and during the debate about the treaty that ended the war. So there was that knowledge. And in addition, there was this, of course, looming crisis that was leading us toward the Civil War, and Mexican Americans took various positions on whether they would support slavery or oppose slavery. Some Mexican Americans were allied with the Southerners. Miguel Antonio Otero was a very prominent politician and rancher who took that position in New Mexico. But others were opposed to slavery. Father Martinez, who was a priest in Taos, New Mexico, was president of the first legislature convened after the war. He argued very strongly that New Mexico should remain a free state if it was going to join the Union and should oppose African slavery. In the end, these New Mexican legislators, who were majority Mexican, did actually support slavery and supported making New Mexico a territory where slavery was legal. This occurred in 1856, so we're talking, you know, right before the Civil War starts. So that's where we would see that Mexican Americans saw in their interest to align themselves with white slaveholders rather than with African Americans. And I argue that part of the reason they did that, at least a significant part of the reason they did that, was because it was favorable for themselves to be seen as aligning with the whites. It was racially useful to them, strategically useful for them to sort of say, hey, we're over here with you white folks, and we're very distant from African Americans.
Yeah, I wonder if you can talk for a minute, Laura, about the extent to which the word white in this country is used as a determiner of race, meant then and means now, above all else, not black.
Yeah, I think that's actually a very cogent way to put that, Chris. I think that makes a lot of sense. One thing that we've seen in terms of Texas history, in terms of New Mexico history, is that sentence would often be changed historically to say, to be white means not black and not Mexican, right? Because Mexicans were in that ambiguous position. But I think it's certainly something that I agree with, that at the bottom of the American racial hierarchy, Americans have held that place. And so one of the dynamics that I think has gone on is that Mexican Americans have been a kind of a wedge group between whites and between African Americans, whites above them and African Americans below them.
And have Mexican Americans also sort of perceived that same hierarchy?
I think that that's true. Yeah, I would say that that's correct, although that question sort of invites a more psychological interpretation than might be what I'm getting at in Manifest Destinies. I'm really trying to look at the more sort of group-level dynamics that occur. And although I think there are many resonances for more contemporary politics and issues such as immigration, I want to kind of remind the readers that I'm looking primarily at the period between 1846, when the U.S. first invades Mexico, and 1912, when New Mexico becomes a state.
Laura E. Gomez is my guest. She's professor of law and American studies at the University of New Mexico. Her new book is called Manifest Destinies, The Making of the Mexican-American Race. You can join the conversation today by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. Coming up, we'll talk about how terms of the U.S. Census Bureau have framed this question and this discussion.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Informal Courses for Adults, offering gift certificates for anyone on your list who loves the arts, languages, writing, history, or travel. Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Professor of Law and American Studies at the University of New Mexico, Laura E. Gomez. Her new book is called Manifest Destinies, The Making of the Mexican-American Race. You can join us by emailing think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. Let's talk to Luis in Dallas. Hi, Luis.
Yes, hello.
Hi, go ahead.
Hi, Chris and Dr. Gomez. I just wanted to make a comment on the comment that Dr. Gomez had made about the equal fraction of the population of Europeans and Africans in Mexico at about 1650, and the assumption that they went on to mix in with the races in about an equal solution, like an equal mix, so to speak. And I would caution that comment because the African population was actually segregated to the states of present-day Veracruz and Tabasco, which didn't allow them to proliferate with the overall population as did the European descendants, which were mainly Spanish, but also very many Germans.
Thank you very much for your call. Do you have a response to that, Laura?
I do. I think that's an important point, and I am pleased that Luis brought it up. I guess I would make a different argument. While I would wholeheartedly agree that at that particular point in time, Africans in Mexico were basically concentrated in those regions, there was tremendous mobility, both in terms of geographic mobility and racial mobility in Mexico. And indeed, one of the factors that I see influencing the fact that Mexican Americans living in the United States today have African ancestry as part of their heritage is that in northern Mexico, which was at the time Texas, California, and New Mexico, and all of the western U.S., basically, that in that region of Mexico, it was particularly desirable for Afro-Mestizos to go to because the restrictions on what mixed-race people could do were fewer because, you know, people were settling the frontier and it was necessary for the Mexican government to loosen up many of those restrictions. So it's one of those debates that we could continue having. It would be hard for us to actually know precisely, but all of the data indicates that those Mexicans who came forward to settle California, Texas, and Mexico had substantial African ancestry, and you know, just over time, that became blended into the mestizaje or racial mixture that Mexicans have today.
To what extent would you say that U.S. Census Bureau terms have framed this question by establishing a list of available labels for officially designating race and ethnicity?
Yeah, that's an important question. I want to answer it by going back in time a little bit, and this is sort of part of one of the themes that I take up in Manifest Destinies is this idea that Mexicans were on the one hand often considered legally white, and on the other hand, almost always considered socially non-white. The census fits into that because if we think about the census category as an official government category or legal category, which it often was used as, historically, Mexicans were counted as within the white population of the U.S., not counted as Indian, not counted as African-American, but counted as white. And that was true for every census preceding the very recent period, except for 1930. In 1930 alone, there was a separate race listed as Mexican, quote-unquote, not Mexican-American, but Mexican, so it was white, Mexican, black, and the other racial categories. And that census coincided, of course, with a period of tremendous economic downturn in the U.S., millions and millions of people unemployed, and eventually led in that decade to the deportation of 500,000 Mexicans and Mexican-American citizens, American citizens of Mexican ancestry. And so the protests that came from Mexican Americans at the time, and sometimes you would hear the term Latin American in Texas, especially at that time. The protest was loud and clear, and by 1940, Mexicans were again counted back in the white category. So with that historical backdrop, to answer your question, I'd come back up to the contemporary period and to the 1980 census. Since 1980, Americans have been asked to answer two questions about race and ethnicity. One question is the race question, which asks, are you white, Asian American, American Indian or Alaskan Native, or African American, in a nutshell? And then a separate question about so-called Hispanic ethnicity, which says, are you Hispanic or not Hispanic? And so that's another way in which Mexicans are presumed to be in the white category rather than in the non-white category.
Laura E. Gomez is my guest. Her new book is called Manifest Destinies, The Making of the Mexican-American Race. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's talk to Nelson in Dallas. Hi, Nelson.
Hello.
Hi. Go ahead, please.
I wanted to ask a question on as to why when we speak of Mexican-Americans, we automatically use the same word Hispanic, even though Mexican-American is one nationality of many, many Latino people. Because I'm a Hispanic of non-Mexican descendant, and I have to argue on the point that even though I speak Spanish and I am Latino, I am not of Mexican ancestry. And then in the rest of Latin America, there's huge differences of races that compose countries like the Dominican Republic or, like, for example, Colombia or Argentina, which is almost all white. Just wanted to know why it's used Mexican-American almost equal to saying Hispanic, which is not.
Well, Nelson, that's a great point. And it's a term that you won't hear Laura using interchangeably. And in fact, she's speaking specifically about Americans of Mexican descent. But perhaps you can clarify that even better, Laura.
Yeah, I would love to address Nelson's comment. I appreciate his calling in. I guess I would... And thank you, Chris, for so forcefully pointing out that I do go to great pains to say that we need to actually separate out that category of Hispanic or Latino to understand who is in that category. Now, Mexican Americans are 60% of all Hispanics in the United States. So I think that's the reason, Nelson, that there's probably often conflation between the two, but there certainly shouldn't be. So if we look at group overall, Hispanics overall, we see very significant differences. Of course, we would see, I don't want to overstate the point, we would see differences among Mexican Americans all the time, of course, too, right? And with among African Americans and so on. But in terms of thinking about, and this is a nice segue back to, I think, the census question that we started talking about before, if we look at how Hispanics of different national origin groups, so let's say Cuban Americans, Argentinian Americans, compared to Mexican Americans and Puerto Ricans, if we looked at how those different groups answered that question of race on the U.S. Census, we find some pretty amazing differences. For example, Hispanics of Argentinian origin and Cuban Americans identify themselves as being in the white race close to 90% of the time. But if you look at Mexican Americans and Puerto Ricans, only half of them identify themselves as being white. The other half of them, well, close to the other half of them, choose the category, quote, some other race, which suggests, I would argue, a rejection of them being classified as white and an adoption of a non-white racial identity.
I want to go back for a minute to the idea of race being something that is assigned by sort of an outside force. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious about places like New Mexico. Did Mexican Americans have a role in sort of assigning race roles to their white neighbors? I'm thinking of the term Anglo, which is used to refer to European Americans who might have no Anglo-Saxon heritage whatsoever.
Yeah, that's right. And I think this is a little bit later than the period that I look at, but if you go back to the documents that I'm looking at, the government documents and court records and other kinds of primary historical documents, people don't use the term Anglo. People use the term Mexican to refer to Mexican Americans, and I say they're Mexican Americans because by this time we're already talking after the war with Mexico, and they use the term American or white to refer to what I call Euro-Americans. And I use that term Euro-American precisely to avoid Anglo, because I want to talk about, you know, German-Americans and Italian-Americans and other Euro-Americans who were here rather than just Anglo-Americans. But we do hear that term. Certainly if you come to New Mexico today, you will hear the terms Hispanic juxtaposed with Anglo, and Anglo becomes a catch-all term here, even to include Jewish Americans, for example, and Americans of other European ethnicities who are not Mexican.
Let's go to those other groups as well, groups of other people from other ethnic groups and national origins. You mentioned Jews and Italians and the Irish, who've been able to sort of convert their status socially in this country so as to be considered fully white within a few generations after arriving as an immigrant group. Why hasn't that happened with Mexican Americans?
Well, I think a couple of reasons. Part of it has to do certainly with the ongoing influx of immigration, right? So that we've over time, between 1848, when these 115,000 Mexicans become American citizens, we've continued to have significant numbers of Mexicans come from the United States and join this population. Now, in terms of the dynamics that we're considering, you know, sort of in terms of having a U.S.-Mexico border that actually operated as a border, we didn't really have that until well into the 20th century. Before that, there was free crossing both south for Americans and north for Mexicans. But since the 20th century, and in particular since 1965, when Congress eliminated the preferences in immigration that were given to European immigrants, and also eliminated the bias in those restrictions or allowances for Asians and for Latin American immigrations, there's been a huge increase in immigration. And I think with that, I think that's a major part of the explanation. But I think the other part of it is that the stereotypes that that many people would say persist today about Mexicans actually originated in the 1840s when the U.S. was engaged in these debates about admitting Texas as a state, when it was engaged in debates about manifest destiny and fulfilling America's you know, rightful place at taking over the continent all the way to the Pacific Ocean and all the way south, and so on. And so those ideas about Mexican racial inferiority come from that time period. And so they're very powerful, persistent ideas in American culture.
1-800-933-5372 is the telephone number if you'd like to speak to my guest, Laura E. Gomez. Her new book is called Manifest Destinies, The Making of the Mexican-American Race. Let's go next to Bert in Dallas. Hello, Bert.
Hello. You know, America faces a lot of grave challenges, and it seems like Americans in general, given the challenges, are a little bit asleep at the wheel when it comes to activism. But when that immigration reform was talked about, I thought it was, and a lot of people thought it was rather amazing, the depth and breadth of the Mexican and just the interested immigrant groups. I mean, they got out in the streets by the thousands, hundreds of thousands, all across the country in peaceful demonstrations, and they got motivated by that issue. And that organization was surprising. And could you talk a little bit about where that came from?
That's a terrific question, Bert. I think that was certainly a new phenomenon in the United States, and what Bert is referring to is the initial April 2006 mobilizations by immigrants and by friends of immigrants to bring attention to their plight and sort of to provide a kind of a counterbalance to the dominant discourse about immigrants, which is very, very negative toward immigrants and especially toward undocumented immigrants. I think part of what was going on there, and I won't pretend to have a complete grasp of it, but I think part of what was going on in those mobilizations was a sense of, we aren't going to take this anymore. We're part of the society, and while we may only begin to be sort of flexing our political muscle, we're going to be flexing that more in the future. You know, there were some signs from those rallies, something to the effect of, we're immigrants today and we're voters tomorrow, and that kind of rhetoric. I think it also goes back to what I mentioned before about the census data. So if you look at, again, looking at Hispanics overall and sort of differences in how different kinds of Hispanics or people situated differently view themselves racially, immigrants of Hispanic origin are more likely to check that some other race box than non-immigrants. And so that's another way in which we see an embracing of a non-white identity. And, you know, it correlates with some other things like feeling economically excluded from the United States, feeling discriminated against, and things such as that.
Now, you point out in the book that New Mexico has actually had a lower level of immigration from Mexico in the past century than a lot of other places in the U.S. But I'm wondering if you can comment a little bit on how the ongoing arrival of immigrants has affected the way Mexican Americans define their identity.
Yeah, I think that the, you know, when we think about how that has changed today, just in my lifetime, and I'm in my 40s, when I was a kid and I was thinking about media to watch or media to listen to, there weren't a lot of, there weren't nearly as many Spanish-speaking radio stations, Spanish-speaking television stations, for example, as there are today. Immigrants and the continuing influx of Mexican immigrants has really become felt, I think, society-wide in terms of American media and culture.
Laura E. Gomez is my guest. She's professor of law and American studies at the University of New Mexico. Her new book is called Manifest Destinies, The Making of the Mexican-American Race. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Informal Courses for Adults, offering gift certificates for anyone on your list who loves the arts, languages, writing, history, or travel. Details at smu.edu/think.
Listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest is Laura E. Gomez, professor of law and American studies at the University of New Mexico. Her new book is called Manifest Destinies, The Making of the Mexican-American Race. An email from Paul in Farmers Branch asks, why do you use the term race in your title and your book when it lacks clear definition and has so many connotations that confuse any discussion?
You know, that's a great question. I thank him for asking it. Race certainly is something that, and I want to be clear to our listeners that I don't believe that race has any independent meaning. Certainly biologists and anthropologists and other scientists have said race doesn't mean anything in terms of saying that there's any real biological difference in among human beings. So I don't use race in that way. Instead, the reason that I use race is because it allows us a sort of a shorthand way to understand about very significant social separation and social exclusion of people in our society. So when I use the term race, I'm intending to invoke that very powerful division in society, which has historically been defined in the law and being been perpetuated through the law against African Americans, and suggesting that that's a important way of looking at Mexicans. Now, just sort of a footnote on that is ethnicity applies to people of all races, right? So if we talk about African Americans, they are among various ethnicities within that one racial group. There are African immigrants, there are Afro-Caribbean blacks, and African Americans, and so on. So I don't mean to use them exclusively, and I certainly don't mean to suggest that there's true biological based differences based on race.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Sarah in North Dallas. Hi, Sarah.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I am so glad that you have this guest on the show. I think this book is very timely. I can't wait to get my hands on it. I, as a Mexican-American, have felt the lashback, all this lashback towards Hispanics in general, and to Mexican-Americans specifically. I am, you know, a Mexican-American born here, third generation. I'm a professional. And even at that level, the professional level, I get still a lot of, backhanded compliments or just amazing, the remarks that are made, you know, that imply that, you're different. You're not like the other Hispanics, or you never see Mexican people, you know, get to your level. And I, even my own kids, who are, by the way, are half white, they also have experienced a lot of that. And but I am glad that she's on board, because she is an expert on the subject, and I think it makes sense, a lot of the stuff that she's saying. I think that race, yes, is very important in this country, like she stated. That's how we're classified, and in fact, it's race is how they keep tabs, and the government, it's important to them. They keep records of that. They make it a priority. The only thing I don't understand, it seems like Mexican Americans have been here for a long time. Like I said, you know, I'm in my almost 50, and I, you know, having been born here and been here all my life, I still feel like I'm not quite part of I know that I'm always treated differently.
Sarah, we'll get a response for you in just a minute from Laura. I just want to ask you very briefly, though. You mentioned that your kids were half white. I say I have an Anglo dad or
right,
a Euro-American
right.
father. How do you put them down, or did you, when they were children, in the census form? So how did you put down their race or ethnicity?
Okay, the school system has little boxes where you check either the first box is white, second one's black, Hispanic or other, and I checked both white and Hispanic. I was told to choose one, and they said, well, whichever I checked first, that's what they would take.
Mm-hmm.
But tell me this, why is it that my kid, by the way, is
okay.
My oldest one is 18, she just got a speeding ticket. And she was,
Sarah,
white.
I'm
as
so
a race.
Yeah. We need to move on, but I think you've brought up some great points, and I really appreciate your call. Thank you so much.
All right, thank you.
Okay, yes, thanks, Sarah, for calling in. Let me just give you a couple of quick responses. One is you know, you really, I think, gave us a human dimension to that backlash that I think a lot of those of us who are Mexican-American, whether we've been here, you know, one or two or 10 generations, are feeling today because of the level of the anti-immigrant, I'm not going to say anti-immigration, but anti-immigrant rhetoric that is so prevalent in our current political discourse. But, you know, one of the things that's interesting about your comments is as of the 2000 census, Americans, for the first time, had the option to check to indicate on the census form that they were multiracial and to indicate their various racial strands. And I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but what was surprising for social scientists who looked at that data was how few Americans took the opportunity to indicate that they were multiracial. So some people were very concerned that that was going to really throw off the stats, but in fact, very people embrace that. I do think a lot of people, people who would identify themselves as Hispanic, continue to check that some other race category as a kind of form of everyday resistance to being categorized as white. And I think that that will probably increase if this anti-immigrant mood continues.
Are things easier for Mexican Americans in a place like New Mexico that has always been, as you called it earlier, a majority-minority state, as opposed to places where the influx of immigrants from Mexico and other Latin American countries has been a relatively recent development?
Yeah, and I should say that there is, you know, there. I don't want to be portraying New Mexico as so much a better place than, say, Texas or California, Arizona, or anywhere else. I think there is a real difference because Mexican Americans in New Mexico are represented in, say, the state legislature, city councils, in very significant numbers. But you know, not in always. For instance, if we look at the New Mexico congressional delegation, we have 3 representatives in Congress and 2 U.S. senators, of course, and none of them are Hispanic, which is kind of a surprise, although we're going to have all 3 of those congressional seats are going to be open because those representatives are seeking Senator Domenici's seat since he's retiring. So that may change when we report about this, you know, after the next round of elections. But I'm not so sure that in all ways, if we dig below the surface, that there aren't deeper racial tensions in New Mexico than people commonly acknowledge.
What about, you know, I think about people like Bill Richardson, and he is openly very proud of his Mexican-American heritage, and he has talked about it a lot on the campaign trail and everywhere else. There's this question of, and I use this term to in the same way that social scientists will use it, not as one that I would embrace myself, but aspiring to whiteness. In other words, at a time in U.S. history, someone like Bill Richardson, with a last name like Richardson, wouldn't have spoken much about his Mexican-American heritage. Do you think today that there are Mexican-Americans who aspire to be treated socially as white people, if you set aside privileges and you just look at culture?
I think that's a complex question. I very much like the way you framed it, and certainly we have to acknowledge that Richardson is campaigning for president at a particular time and place, and in that time and place, it becomes a political advantage to say that one is Hispanic, and particularly perhaps in a way that he is Hispanic, which is to say that he's half American and half Mexican, one parent being Mexican, one parent having been born in the United States. And to have grown up fully acculturated, bilingual in English and Spanish, there's not a lot for him to lose in a sense. You know, it's interesting also that Richardson looks the way that he does because he looks Hispanic, right? You could easily be Mexican-American and not look so different and sort of pass for white in various contexts. I think data coming out of Texas is particularly interesting. For instance, there are 2 sociologists who've recently done a study comparing Mexican Americans in San Antonio and Los Angeles. And those people in San Antonio, Mexican Americans in San Antonio, were much more likely to speak Spanish, to live in Mexican American neighborhoods, and to embrace a Mexican American heritage, but at the same time to define themselves more conservatively as white and so on. So I think there's kind of a duality here with people wanting to be fully included as Americans, and the fact that historically that has so often meant you had to be white to be fully included in the U.S., and at the same time wanting to maintain their ties and their heritage as Mexican Americans as well.
I think we have time for one more call, and that is Bob in Dallas. Hello, Bob.
Yes, good afternoon. My question follows up on something that you just brought up, actually. I have a home in Santa Fe, New Mexico, as well as here in Texas, and I noticed a distinct difference in my understanding of how new immigrants are treated in New Mexico versus in Texas. And let me explain my comment. In Texas, I get my yard mowed for about $200 a month. In New Mexico, it costs me like $1,000 a month. And the reason is because I do not see the illegal immigrants or the new immigrant population there to anything like the same extent I see it in Texas. And I'm just wondering if that is because that the existing Hispanic population there is less welcoming, more self-policing, or we work with new immigrants here in the States, my wife and I do, and so this is understand my comment in that context, but I'm just wondering if you're against my comment on that. Thank you very much.
Thanks for your call.
I think probably the chief reason there's far less immigration, Mexican immigration into New Mexico proportionally, is there just isn't the same economic draw, not in the same numbers, right, that we don't have large industries or manufacturing in New Mexico the way that other states have it. And, you know, in population, we're still a small state, and so we don't have the same kind of need for service workers. Now, that's not to say that there still isn't significant Mexican immigration. And, in fact, there's some significant tensions or fault lines between Mexican-born immigrants and Mexican-Americans who've been here for many, many generations. But you're absolutely right that there's not the same pool of immigrant workers that there is in the very large and sort of economically booming states of Texas and California.
You've written that some of your thinking on this topic was the outgrowth of some questions that your 10-year-old son asked you about his own racial and ethnic heritage. Have you settled on good answers for him?
Well, you know, I continued to, as everyone who has children knows, it's always a adventure hearing their various questions. So the question that Chris is referring to was one morning over breakfast, my son said, "Mom, are we white or are we black?" And I had to give him a pretty complex answer. But really, what he was, I think, trying to do is ask that question at a subconscious level, probably for him. But where do we fit, Mom? Where do we fit in the United States? And that's the question that I think Mexican Americans continue to ask themselves. And my book, I think, is an effort to say, rather than just think of African Americans and whites and to think of race in that way, let's broaden out that discussion and realize there are a lot of different racial groups in the U.S. with complex and long histories in the United States that we should take account in terms of our daily life, in terms of politics, and even in terms of elementary school social studies.
Do you think that Americans are better equipped to handle the nuances of a discussion that is not just two main races?
Absolutely. I think that is increasing all the time. I think oftentimes we talk about America today as being a multiracial nation. I guess what I'm saying is, well, we don't have to just talk about that in the contemporary context or in the even post-1965 context when those immigration laws occurred, but we should really go back to the 19th century and see that there were very significant racial diversity in the United States at that time.
Laura E. Gomez is professor of law and American studies at the University of New Mexico. Her new book is called Manifest Destinies, The Making of the Mexican-American Race. Laura, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro, with production assistance from Maggie Conklin. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.